there is that moment where it just galvanizes it. And you know whether you want it or not, with the super odd occasion when maybe there's been some politics behind the scenes that you weren't privy of, but usually you know whether you nailed it. And that, for me, in those moments of flow, that feels like alchemy.
Welcome to the Alchemist Lounge. What if you could hang out with high-performing executives, entrepreneurs, and leaders? Ask them about how psychedelics have impacted their self-improvement journeys. Then take an insight or two to guide your own growth. Each week, Alex Atwood takes an in-depth look at how psychedelics can increase fulfillment, solve personal problems affecting your career, and help you gain the success you seek. Alex is an executive and psychedelics coach to high performers, and his goal is to provide strategies to help you reduce conflict, bring awareness, and balance your life through the use of psychedelics. Now, here's Alex.
Everyone, welcome to the show. Today we have Marcus Druin. Marcus, how are you?
I'm very well. Thank you very much. Thanks for having me on the podcast, Alex.
It's such a pleasure. And today it happens to be the third day of January. And so that means is a new year. So whenever you're listening to this, it's being recorded on the third day of January, 2023. And I'd like to start off because the New Year's is a time when people desire to change things, right? That aren't in their lives. They add resolutions. They think of things that aren't working. And more often than not, they go back to the same way of being over a period of time. So I'm curious, what's your thought about that way of thinking?
Yeah, so it goes right into the heart of what I do for a living, which is change at the level of self, in relationships, in teams, in organizations. What I've come to learn is that you really need to change a structure in your life so that a new path of least resistance can then flow around that structure. So why is that so important? When you look at nature, when you look at a river, you see water flowing through, and there might be rocks and boulders in it. And you see how the water flows around it. And if you want to change the water, just take the boulder out or put another boulder in. And very quickly, that water will take a new path of least resistance. Now, in our brains, when we talk about neuroplasticity and in general, when we talk about neuroscience, we are stuck in a rut. I don't know if it's an American saying, but in British English, that's a typical way to say you are stuck in repetitive patterns. So if you want to change something when you're stuck in a rut, you need to change something at the structural level of your brain, which is where all sorts of chemicals fly around, dopamine, cortisol, adrenaline, and so forth. And so with New Year's resolutions, it's great to have a name, brilliant, and it's more important to really think about how can I now create a structure so that whatever I want to become or whatever I want to change in my life has a fair chance.
I love that. Well, first of all, I love the analogy of a stream and putting a boulder there, and the stream inevitably must take a different route. So what a brilliant way to point at the structures in your life and how most of the time, even though you make a resolution, you haven't taken the time to look at the structures that have enabled whatever that way of being that isn't working is. So that is brilliant. That is absolutely brilliant. And something I'd like to add to that to a small degree is, and I was listening to a podcast recently, I think it was Russell Brand, and he said that change is possible if we collectively will it. So what does that mean to you? And how do we collectively will something anyway?
Well, this is the big conundrum, because at some level, I can only change myself. I can't change anyone else, right? However, yeah. If I change, let's just say I become more empathetic or more patient, whatever, then the people around me, they can't help but adapt to my change. And that then catalyzes a change on their end. Now, most of the time, these things happen unconsciously and probably even not explicitly between people. But when you turn this into an intention, when you say, okay, what's our shared aim here? Okay, we want to create a new system. That system needs to be more fair, more transparent, more equitable, and so forth, which in my world is a lot about Web3. That's something that really excites me. And that's how you can then orchestrate a lot of people through global coordination to do the same thing. And there's a point which I think refers to a law of physics. It's called the Schelling point. And the Schelling point is a time space where you know something's going to happen and you know you want to be there, but you don't know exactly, you don't have to know exactly where and when it's going to happen. That's the Schelling point. So practical example, there's going to be a huge rally on Parliament Square in London or somewhere in New York or DC or wherever. And you just know it's going to happen and when. You just show up. Miraculously, you show up. Maybe you are 10 minutes off or a kilometer off or a mile off, but then you will see people going all in the same direction. So you realize, okay, this is where it must happen. And so this is why we have to have shared aims in order to really change something. Because if we all pull into different directions, that's what we have at the moment with an incredibly polarized society.
Mm. But I guess for like a practical way, if you're a business owner, and the coaching that you do, from what I've seen, is mainly around groups and organizations, right? Mm. So if you're a business owner or manager or something like that, and you really want to cause change, you want to transform your group, what I heard was it starts with an intention. Mm. But tell me a little bit about how that intention can actually evolve into a sustainable change within a group.
Yeah, so this gets us into what's the opposite of a shared aim? It's to have sources of conflict, right? And there are three main sources of conflict. There's different interests, different perspectives or points of views, and then different values. And they all require different remedies. So if you have different interests, I want to go to the Thai and you want to go to the Italian. How do we do that? We have to negotiate. You can negotiate different interests. Like business interests, economic interests. This is, if you look at it, even at a global level, right, with the Economic Forum and the UN, it's all based on interests and negotiations. So that's that. Then how do you solve the second like source of conflict, different perspectives? Well, it's all about listening and like really active listening and being curious, almost like going on a joint exploration together to see what the other person actually really means when they say X. And this is where language is so important. We have to deconstruct language. We have to do a lot of inquiry and really ask people, what do you mean by that? This is how you can solve that dilemma. And then the third one, having different values. Well, not just in business, but also in my private life, I've just come to the realization that the best thing and almost the only thing you can do to rectify that is to just tolerate, to just accept and tolerate and give in, because you ain't going to change anyone's values. It's not going to happen. So either you can then go together because you are enough on the metaphorical same page, or you don't. So let's wrap this up. We turn the three sources of conflict by putting the right remedy in. And now we have shared interests. We have shared values. And when it comes to different perspectives, it's good to have some that are similar and some that remain diverse. Because if we all would think the same, it would be groupthink. And that conversation in itself is a whole day worth of team development. To just have a normal conversation about your strategy, about OKRs, about the product, and to then go on the metaphoric balcony and really dissect whenever something feels a little bit like edgy, a little bit not quite flowing like earlier with the river and the water. If some, out of a sudden there's a boulder now in the flow of the team. Really think about what is it that we all can observe here, and then name it, name the elephant, address the issue. And through that process, which is very much a social process, has nothing to do with business as such, but through that social process, we can now look at management tools like OKRs, Objective Key Results, or Lean Startup methodology. And now we can encode at a much more practical business-oriented level, what you're talking about, that kind of like shared vision, shared aim, shared direction. It's two things. It's the what and the how.
Ah, and we start with the social aspect of it. Is that right?
Well, ideally you do. And most of the time, people don't. And this is where it falls flat. I've been guiding teams and witnessing teams sometimes for many, many years. And no matter what conversation they have the same problems. Because it's the how, it's the people. It's not the topic.
Yeah.
It's always the people.
Yeah, it's always the people. Have you seen a big shift in the companies that you work with? Have you seen more transformation happening in terms of relating to the people in the organization? Or are you seeing it still being somewhat stagnant?
So the biggest shift that I've seen in the last 3 years, and that is decidedly because this is pre-COVID, post-COVID, pre-lockdown, post-lockdown.
Yeah.
That triggered a lot of change and shifts in people in their private lives and also at work. And pre-COVID, it was very difficult to get seasoned executives to show vulnerability. This whole classic Brené Brown thing, like there can't be confidence and courage without vulnerability, right? A lot of people would struggle to the point where they wouldn't even answer my coaching questions or my facilitation questions because they were so afraid to just, you know, put their pants down and just, yeah, show the world what they really think or what they really like. And I find it absolutely amazing that it took 2 or 3 years of Zooming, which a lot of people claim they dislike, but yeah. I actually witnessed the shifts, not despite of Zoom, but because of Zoom. Somehow people found it really easy to converse with people around the globe, go straight in, have a quick check-in, and then talk about what's really going on. Because how can you not talk about the kids that are running around in the background? It's impossible. So my experience with COVID lockdowns and Zoom, I know there's lots of shit that happened in many, many ways, but there was one real gem that emerged from it. And that is that people in my world, the people that I work with, are now so much more vulnerable and they are so much more ready to really talk about their personal issues. Again, it's the what and the how. And how can you talk about the how, but constantly exclude people's private lives? That makes no sense. When we talk about wholeness and holistic thinking, you got to talk about that. So that's probably the biggest shift that I've been seeing in my clients. And I can give you a very, very specific example. There was an executive of a global software company that I always wanted to work with. And he was the classic robot when it came to it. And I asked him, so how can your team help you? He froze and then he doubled down. And then unfortunately I doubled down and the whole thing didn't really go like neither one of us wanted. So I didn't show my vulnerability either. And then fast forward, just before Christmas, we had a really, really powerful workshop with one of our clients. It's a VC firm. And they really told each other what needed to be heard, what was said before and what wasn't heard before, or what hasn't been said before because people were holding it back. And I'm obviously not going into specific details, but it was very profound. That like they've never said these things to each other before, ever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's incredible how much conditioning has gone into the way that we act in terms of our guarding our vulnerabilities and who we are. And I think some of the terminology that we use in the business world, right? It's work-life balance. I hear that a lot. And when I hear that, what I hear is somehow when you're at work, you're no longer alive. And somehow when you're alive, you don't, like there's some sort of like line, like, oh, here I am at work. My life is no longer existing, right? And that just isn't how it works. I mean, isn't life continuous? Isn't all of it life, whether it's work, whether it's physical well-being, whether it's relationships, it all sort of falls under life. And I'm wondering what you think about like that idea of work-life balance. In other words, there has to be a separation between work and life. Because what you're pointing at least what I'm hearing, is that no, people bring their lives into work all the time. And on Zoom, that was a very clear way of people actually bringing their home lives into work. And that opened up vulnerability. What would you say about that?
Yeah, work-life balance is a weird term for me anyways, yeah, because I've been self-employed for a long time. And yeah, to your point, so I guess it all comes back or it all traces back to the reductionist thinking that we've been honed for the last 300-400 years since the Enlightenment and the scientific revolution, where we think we can compartmentalize things, in particular in matter space. So it's object A and object B, and they clearly are separate. There's work, there's life, and they clearly are separate. But what about energy? Energy is not separate at all. The energy that's oscillating between you and me has been around for 13 billion years. Because energy never goes away. It doesn't get created in a system and it doesn't go away. It just shifts constantly. And that's why change is the only constant, because it's a constant shifting of energy. And when you make that switch in your thinking, then any separation makes no sense. And work-life balance as a case in point doesn't make any sense. And to bring it back to bringing your whole person to work, if that is on a Zoom call or in office, doesn't really matter. How about your energetic vibration? Mm. You cannot separate that. If you had a bad argument in the morning with your partner, and so you are on a contracting energetic state, you are maybe in shame and guilt or still in anger, and now you need to be this inspiring leader that communicates to the people. I know people who do that and who are actually good at doing that. They are also people who then after work do all sorts of things to be able to look in the mirror. And they are not healthy. I'm talking about addictions. I'm talking about all sorts of coping mechanism to actually do it again, repeat next day. Brave face in the morning. Oh, fucking hell. I've got kids and wife and can't really cope. Driving to work or putting the Zoom, the thingy up in the background to blend the family life out. And all of a sudden, oh, here I am. It's just not working anymore. It has always been weird. But I think in the last few years, catalyzed by a number of developments in society, I think people are really waking up to the fact that we're all freaking humans and we are winging it every day. And so let's just stop this whole nonsense of separating things artificially.
Mm, that's exactly right. And a word that came to mind is authenticity, right? Like that same scenario, had that leader come in and perhaps maybe not shared in detail, but just shared that, hey, this morning was a rough morning. And I may not come off as the jubilant leader that you always expect. There's something in those words, if a leader or a manager, someone is willing to do that, or even somebody who's sort of a patriarch or a matriarch of a family, right? Who just says that, there's something that opens up there, some sort of understanding, because we all feel that, right? And that leads to connectedness, which is what I'm absolutely hearing. That's brilliant. That's brilliant. So in your pre-interview, I have a question. This is obviously the Alchemist Lounge, and you are an alchemist, an audacious alchemist in your own words. Tell me about the audacious alchemist. Where did that come about?
So I play with personas in my inner family system. I've got mainly three. So let's start with the first order principle. I am called Marcus, but the three names that I play with and work with every day and that I embody are Axel, Antonius, and Aurelius. So Axel is my inner child, and I had a really adverse childhood. In the first 10 months, I was taken away by the authorities and then adopted into a very affluent but emotionally quite complicated family. And for that, I, through a psychedelic experience, particularly with San Pedro, I was able to give birth to my inner father because I never had that figure in my life. So that's Aurelius, my inner father. And then this year, I realized that, hey, this middle name that I always hated, I thought, like, what a preposterous name to call your child Marcus Antonius in a steel and coal mine town in Germany, right? It's like, oh, you... If you want to be bullied, if you want to make sure your kids gets bullied in a school like that kind of town, call him Marcus Antonius. So that Antonius has never resonated with me until this year. Again, catalyzed by psychedelic experience, I thought, do you know what? You are such a late bloomer and the inner leader is only really starting to wake up. It's almost like whatever I've been doing in the last, let's say, 1.5 years starts to make everything else that I've done in my career before look like a footnote. And so I thought, I already got Aurelius, I got Axel, so let's create Antonius. And because of certain influences like Joe Dispenza and the law of attraction, I thought, well, Antonius needs to have an adjective, and abundant came to mind. So I've got abundant Antonius. And abundant Antonius has three sub-personas that are really, because that's quite ethereal, it's a bit spiritual, it doesn't really lend itself to any manifestation other than abundance, right? Which is great in itself, but on here on Earth, in meat suit space, how am I going to actually show up? So the three sub-personas are the audacious alchemist, the agile athlete, and the altruistic ancestor.
Always. I like it.
That's what I basically aspire to on a daily basis. And I create alchemy. I mentioned earlier the energetic vibrations. Let's just say I wake up a bit grumpy or a bit moody or a bit sad or whatever. It's a contracting vibration state. Now, how do I get to an expanding state? Well, I've got my morning routine. And by carefully crafting and iterating on my morning routine, I can get myself into an expanding state within 60 to 90 minutes, almost, I would say, 9 out of 10 times. I would actually say it's more like 95 out of 100 times. So that's alchemy. How do you do that? Well, you have to put in the work.
Yeah. So these personas are fascinating. Do you embody these personas? Like, will you get up and say, I'm lacking abundance today? Antonius, come here. You're the abundant one. I'm going to embody you today. And you then embody Antonius with all of this abundance. Is that what it looks like?
Yeah, I do have. So
very cool.
I do go through my day. So I do some visualization. I've got some, there's this metaphor of if you want to get shit done and there's a big glass vessel of water, you need to first put the boulder in. And then afterwards you put the little stones in. And then you put the sand in and then the water in. So the boulder is always the single most important thing to do in the morning. And this is a mixture of the audacious alchemist, because sometimes it's very creative, but sometimes it just requires grit. It just requires me to, come on, you got to write these three emails to these three clients, otherwise you're not going to do it after lunchtime. So that's more like the agile athlete. Like when I was very young, like almost my son's age, I was quite good in swimming. And so I was an athlete. And yeah, I know what athlete-like is like. You're not second-guessing anything. Like, that's not how you become good at anything in any sport, right? An athlete gets up in the morning, whether it's 4, 5, or 6, and you turn on this, and you know exactly what you're now going to do. And so for me, that means I do breath work in bed, meditation still in bed. Then I do some abundant, you can call it abundant thinking or visualization. So how could abundance show up today? And then I go out of bed and then I go straight into my stretching routine. I've got quite a few tools and props to mixture of yoga and Pilates. And then I round it off. And this, I can tell by that time how easy it's now going to be or whether I now need to pull more my athlete face on. And then going into the garden for a cold shower, no matter what the temperature is outside. And then I start to create, and creating can be all sorts of different things. Can be the breathwork course, can be creating moments of truth with my clients, whether that's alchemy or not. But when you pitch competitively, like against other consultancies for a decent pot of money, there is that moment where it just galvanizes it. And you know whether you want it or not, with the super odd occasion when maybe there's been some politics behind the scenes that you weren't privy of, but usually you know whether you nailed it. And that, for me, in those moments of flow, that feels like alchemy, because in hindsight, I look back, it's like, wow, how did we make that happen?
I know, I get it. I relate so strongly to that. As a matter of fact, most of the quote-unquote successful people, not just in the field of psychedelics, but in really any field, have some sort of ritual. Some of them are healthier, some of them are not. But what you just described to me is very similar to something that I do in the mornings. And what I find that it really helps with is, and this is, again, going to sound kind of ethereal, but it really connects your body, mind, and your spirit and brings you to a centered place of now, where you can really have a perspective about what's possible for a given day. And I would say anybody listening to this, if you don't have a ritual, it's probably one of the most game-changing things that I've done in my life. And the way you're describing it, Marcus, a day without that ritual, could it go? Well, yeah, it could. But why not put that in to be able to create your own sort of alchemy using what's in the universe now, what you have, what you bring to the universe? Brilliant. Just very brilliant. You touched on your childhood, and I want to know a little bit more about it. I'd love to hear what you were passionate about growing up and whether or not there was a seed planted at some point in your childhood that eventually evolved into Marcus of today.
Yeah. So I feel very blessed. I've done a lot of healing work and I've done a lot of forgiving to all the people involved. So whatever I say now comes from a position of love. It was certainly a very adverse childhood in the first 10 months. And I'm the product of two hippies living in a commune, having sex with one another. And then, oops, out of a sudden, little Axel, that's my birth name, little Axel is born. And yeah, there was a lot of neglect. There wasn't regular food. There wasn't regular heating. And 10 months in, the authorities on the third checkup basically told my then 17-year-old mom, he's not going to go home with you today. He's going to stay here. And the biological dad had already disappeared a few months before. And then I was thrusted into this super, like, hardcore, probably upper middle class or aspiring middle class, both academics. My dad's an entrepreneur, he's an architect, and my mom is a primary school teacher. And we talk a lot about intergeneration trauma and toxic shame that's being passed on from your parents to yourself. So I've only really figured this out in the last few years. It just sort of like comes in waves, and it's almost like another layer of the onion gets peeled away of who am I really, and why am I me, and why am I here, and what is my purpose? So there's all this purpose work out in business, and that's great. My relationship to purpose is every human being has an evolutionary purpose, no matter what that is, because we are all part of 8 billion people we call humanity is one species, and that is all part of what we call Gaia, planet Earth. So we have got to have, there's no way we could not have, each one of us, an evolutionary purpose. And so the first colossal, I've got a few things that I notice when I do body work, breath work, or trauma release with the source muscle that seem to come up. One is, and this is the first, I was born with a emergency cesarean. And when I started to follow the work of Stan Grof, I was like, holy moly, a few things make sense now, given how I was actually pulled out of that body of my biological mom. That's the first one. And the second one is, okay, 10 months in, you can't speak, and out of a sudden, the single most important person in your life disappears. And you are then in the care of two other people that make it feel all nice. I was sick, they made me healthy, and over the first 2-3 years, everything seemed to be really going nice, even though it probably must have been quite weird to just not have your next of kin touching you. And then things started to get a bit dark, particularly with my mum. Back in the days, I think, yeah, a lot of people beat their kids. I think my mum probably took it a few steps further than most other people. So that created some quite profound trauma that I'm still releasing on today. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing that probably had a super strong impact on also my adult life is I'm a bit neurodiverse. Not quite sure I would qualify as an autist, but I definitely have autistic traits. And my son has a diagnosis. So there seems to be something in the lineage in there as well. So if you look at my childhood and my teenage years, I was in the wrong life. Nothing was flowy except when I was in nature and when I could do physical activities in nature. So surfing, skiing, swimming. I was an athlete swimmer. And then later on, like, it's not really mountaineering or climbing. It's like, we call it scrambling in the UK. So it's quite, mm-hmm. you and via ferratering, where you have a fixed rope where you get up in a harness, but it's not the same as alpine climbing. So I remember the most blissful moments, let's say, as a teenager and then also as an early adult, they were all in that scenario, nature and physical activity and being in my own head, because I had a lot to process and I'm very extrovert. So I always needed the complete retreat from people. And I would go on surf trips for 3 weeks on an outer island in Scotland with about 50 people and 5,000 sheep. That would be like how I would restore and recharge my batteries.
Mm. Very interesting. And so now you have psychedelics that you've incorporated and learned, the powerful, powerful results that can be experienced through a psychedelic journey. How did you discover psychedelics?
Yeah. So at some point in anyone's life, and I see this now with someone very close to us who attempted suicide. At some point in your life, you have to take responsibility for yourself. You can't blame parents or teachers or anyone else. And yes, there is an artificial age called the age of consent, 18, it used to be 21, but some people might not get there in their 30s or 40s. And some people might have to actually get there in their early teens, because if someone else doesn't give you the environment that you need, then you need to do that. The reason why I'm mentioning that is I then failed colossally over the next two decades to assume that responsibility in my life. And it culminated...
Since your teenage years.
Yeah. Since I moved out. When I was 19, I moved out and, you know, started my career, studied and all the rest of it, moved to England, got married, had a son. And throughout all of that time, I never stepped fully into my power, as in into my responsibility. This is my life. Yes, this happened in the past. I've got the tools. I've got the resources. Let's sort this out. I just failed miserably. And I was an angry man, if you want to call it that way. And then the absolute rock bottom was in 2013. So like it was like 8 years ago in December, when I nearly drowned based on a catastrophic risk assessment that I had done on something called a wave ski, which is a mixture of a kayak and a surfboard. And I wanted to try it out because it's good for really choppy small waves on the south coast in the UK, not really that good for surfing. And yeah, I just capsized and I couldn't get out of the belt and I nearly drowned. And the more important part of that experience was I had a complete ego dissolution, complete non-dual experience. It was blissful. There was no narrative. It was just okay with what was happening to me. And then because it was close to the shore, the people that saw me, my ex-wife, she screamed them into the water eventually when I didn't come up anymore. They put me out. Now, at that point, I have an existing yoga practice and a fledgling meditation practice, but I never taken psychedelics before. And because of that experience, I could now really relate to what in particular one of my yoga teacher was talking about. I was like, okay, wow, this is really profound. And also at the same time, I had some mates who had started to invite me to house parties in their own home, in their own street. And that was the first time I'd ever taken MDMA. And I was absolutely blown away by it. I had completely different preconceptions on what this might do to me. I really liked it. And I think 2-3 sessions in, this accident happened. And I knew that they also took mushrooms, psilocybin mushrooms. And this is when it all came together. Tim Ferriss, he was the first podcaster alongside Joe Rogan to really put it out. And I thought like, okay, well, this stuff like MDMA, psilocybin, and now even cannabis, this can be taken in a completely different set and setting. And I was super lucky that I had a therapist of probably 4 or 5 years at the time who I could just talk openly about this. Turns out she was a hippie in the 60s, 70s in India, so she knew all about it. And I basically benefited from what we now call psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy. And that was the turning point, not a single event, but the 2-3 years of really doing that on a regular basis was the turning point to become from a blame gamer, like life happens to me, it's all your fault, to someone that says, no, no, I'm in charge here, I create. And whatever I choose, it's a consequence I need to live with. So that's like 6-7 years of going through that phase in my life, mainly assisted MDMA and psilocybin. And then about 3 years ago, I then got into more different medical compounds or plant medicine. So ayahuasca, San Pedro, and then also ketamine, actually. And that's when I had, again, more... I crossed another threshold and I'm now in this phase where I'm more co-creating than creating. And that requires, as you probably know, you have to let go. You have to trust the process. And that really, really only happened in the last... In fact, it was massively catalyzed by the retreat that we had as part of the Third Wave Coaching Program in Costa Rica in Brave Earth. I just had this moment with the source, or other people call it God. I had full-blown mystical experience. And the voice just said, after hours of just lying there, let it go. I'm like, what? yeah, just let it go. It's like, no, that's not that easy. No, it is. That's exactly how it works. And that was it. That was the only thing in terms of language, narrative, script, or whatever you want to call it, that I can remember from this beautiful experience. It was, other than that, just pure being. And so when I then came out of it and started to integrate it, the first thing that I could immediately put into practice and embody and really, really execute was to offer to my son to live with us. So at the time, he was here only 30%. His mom was going to move to Cornwall, which is like 4 or 5 hours drive away. He's in special needs school. It doesn't exist there. All of a sudden, I realized, okay, this is not what I signed up for because of the way we divorced. But okay, let it go and let him come. And he's been living with us since September. And it is one of the most profound decisions I ever made in my life, especially with my history of basically my biological dad disappearing.
Wow.
Yeah.
Talk about healing trauma and ancestral trauma.
Mm.
Wow. That is fascinating. So your first psychedelic experience was a near-death experience, and you consider that psychedelic, which I actually do as well. And that was a catalyst for you to come down this path. So let me ask you, so how much influence does your psychedelic work have on your organizational coaching and leadership practice?
So at the moment, they run in parallel. I've got a consultancy called Audacify, like we make work more audacious or change more audacious, and I've got a business partner there. And then I've got this sidekick project called, it's quite a long, wieldy name, the Psychedelic Map for Change, or short, the PMFC. And that is where I anchor my integration coaching practice on, where I also then collaborate with people like Anna Badila, who's been on your podcast, and we put out a breathwork course. And at the moment, what I can see is that we are, I would say half of the people in the breathwork and the psychedelic space, they could also be my clients. But what I haven't quite squared yet is how do we get this on companies' balance sheets? Because at the moment, the people here, if they then go on a psychedelic, the corporate clients or the entrepreneurs I work with, they pay this out of their own pocket, basically. So this is my big aim, to eventually harmonize them, to have psychedelic assisted professional development, psychedelic assisted team development.
I would love that. Yeah, I would love that. As a matter of fact, on my third ayahuasca retreat, there was two business owners there who brought some of their employees, and they had a profound experience and such a closeness that they left there with. And they were planning on taking what they learned and their new sense of openness and understanding and clarity into the company. And I remember at that point, I thought, that's brilliant. That's something I want to do in my business. And I'll add a point here that there is now consideration around psychedelic medicine being covered by insurance. Uh-huh. And so if that industry will cover it, then I think we're onto something in terms of actually being able to, like you said, merge the two into one so that you can give a true holistic service that really kind of takes care of the inside, the outside, the energy, and really shows a lot of possibility. So with your psychedelic map for change, what do you see as being the end goal there? Like, what do you see as being the real impact that something like that can have on not just the business community, but the community of humans around the world?
Yeah, so we have pressing need to wake up, grow up, and show up. Mm. Something's got to happen very, very quick. And over Christmas, because of various really, really disruptive events, not just my partner's niece, but also other things, I just had this profound realization that at an intellectual level I had for a long time, but I just really had to say in my body, Alex, this is on us now. It's you and me and your listeners. Like, I'm 48. I can't pinpoint to anyone above me anymore. It's on us. It's on me. We are the people we've always been waiting for. And we have to make this work now. We have inherited something. The world as it is not the world we created. And now we can shift it, right? And so what the Psychedelic Map for Change aims for is to be a macro framework with a lot of micro tools in it. And what I mean by that is, in my line of work, I'm a systemic change consultant. We often talk about, so you've got the level of self, the level of team, organization. And triggered by COVID, I realized that almost 80% of what happens inside the different businesses, whether it's a startup, a Web3 company, a corporation, or even an NGO, is defined by the economic incentive structures that we create at a more societal level or global economy level. And unless we don't go there and change that, no matter what I and other people are doing and the leaders with the good intentions, it ain't gonna happen, at least not fast enough and profound enough. So the macro framework really helps people to understand that you are all these levels. It's not like you're you and then there's the organization, or you're you and then there's society. No, for fuck's sake, you are the society. Every single time you vote, you're a citizen. Every single time you pay product or service, you're a consumer, and you do have a choice. So we do help people with a lot of step-by-step micro coaching tools to understand what is it like and what could it be. And there are really three questions that start the entire process. What's going well for you? What's holding you back? And what's puzzling you? And you can spend an hour on that. You can spend a whole day on that, different levels of depth. But you will be able to create an inventory of green, yellow, and red post-its, like on a mirror board. And that's your launch pad into, okay, what is this all about? Okay, I have a self-limiting belief. I'm not good enough. Okay, how can I change that? And that brings it back to what I said at the beginning. I can now think about structures that I can change in my life so that then this self-limiting belief can just disappear. We don't solve our problems at that level. We outgrow them.
I love that. What's going well for you? You said the second thing is, where do you get stuck? What are you struggling with?
Yeah.
And the third thing again was, what can you do about it? Is that right?
What's puzzling you?
What's puzzling you? I love that. I love that. And then you take an inventory.
Mm.
Ah, brilliant. Brilliant. There was something that another thing I heard, I made a note about it here. What would you do if you weren't afraid? I remember I'd listened to a podcast and I'd love for you to answer that for me.
I would be non-judgmental, always coming from a position of love, always trying things out and see what happens. Because when we are afraid, we are in a contracting state. And in particular, fear can be quite debilitating. So if I wasn't afraid, I would be a lot more outspoken, for instance, about certain things that I think need to happen at a political level, where quite frankly, at the moment, I have no incentive to do so because there can be quite bad repercussions, depending on where you live. Even though I live in the UK, would I really want to join an Extinction Rebellion rally? Probably not, because these people are getting locked up left, right, and center. But if I wasn't afraid, I would exactly do that.
Mm. Very, very specific. And you know, we are in this unique time where there's a lot of gray area. There's, depending upon the country you're in, there's not so gray area. And yet there's so much insight and slow destigmatization of psychedelics. So we get to really, as a group, as a singular group, the listeners, you, me, as you said, we get to define and co-create what psychedelics mean for generations ahead of us. And my final question, because I hear this so much, I think there is definitely a wave, as we know, as being part of the third wave of psychedelics and a different meaning that they now take on. But what do you tell people who are still hesitant, who find that psychedelics are still dangerous and feel that they couldn't commit to them, or there's no, you know, no protocol? How do you address those type of concerns and fears around psychedelics?
I developed a hack, and the hack is the breathwork course. And breathwork is something you can do with people immediately. So in my work, I very often do pranayama breathing, 4 in, hold for 4, 8 out. When people get stressed, right, that might be ground zero for someone to actually think like, oh gosh, I feel really, really different now. Okay, well, let's do it for 25 minutes, conscious connected breathing, right, and see what happens. And then they really get high, quote unquote. And then that conversation about, so what are altered states, takes a very different turn, very different pathway now. Because now we can talk about, okay, so it's all in your body, the medicine just activates it, and you will most likely, at least if you do this regularly, it might happen on the first occasion, it might happen on the 10th, you will at some point experience profound fear or whatever, something that's incredibly destabilizing. Now, why would you want that? Because you will be shown in the most salient possible way by the medicine what's in your shadow. And that's why you want to do that. Do you not want to change? Do you not want to be more empathetic and more listening? More patient? Yeah, I do. Well, that is a tool to do that. Yeah, but, you know, yeah, it's a drug if you do it recreationally, and it's a medicine if you do it with a specific intention and a really, really safe set and setting. And if you integrate it afterwards. So I actually do talk to people that have taken no drugs in their life whatsoever, not even cannabis. And interestingly, because of all the media coverage of the clinical approach, in particular the people that have PhDs or are very scientifically minded, which are historically the most reductionist people, and they cannot imagine what a mystical experience is like. But they're actually coming around it because they think, yeah, but the data doesn't lie. So I often talk about the clinical trial, like the efficiencies and, you know, how it really helps people. And that seems to be a bit of a door opener. And as I said, breath work in the here and now, just getting someone that visceral experience of what it feels like. And then they're like, oh, is it like, what, 10 times or 100 times or 1,000 times? Well, I said, well, that's a different conversation. But it's the one thing is you can't stop it. And if you try to stop it, the medicine is going to show you its boss. Whereas the breath work, the holotropic breath work, you can stop at any time. And then maybe it takes 1 or 2 minutes for the tetany, if it arises, to just wean off. But if you are on a 6 to 8 hour trip, you are on it.
I can vouch for, personally, some breath work that I've done, for me personally, has been more powerful than ayahuasca. Mm. And I was on an ayahuasca retreat, went into a breathwork session thinking, you know what, I just did 2 nights of ayahuasca. This will be a nice break. And I was yelling. My body was convulsing. It was something else. So to those who have not tried holotropic breathwork, I absolutely, wait, first, don't take my experience. You may not have the same experience, but it is absolutely powerful. And it's a great either supplement to psychedelic for those who aren't comfortable with psychedelics yet. It's a great entryway. So thanks so much for coming on the show, Marcus. This was such a fascinating conversation. I think we touched on everything. What's next for you?
Good point. This is actually my New Year's conundrum, which I haven't solved quite yet. So we've got the breathwork course that starts on the 11th of January. And I'm putting out a more classic academic teaching course out also on a platform called maven.com. Going to go into an accelerator, do it together with other teams. And then probably in February, that's going to be live as well. So really not psychedelic stuff, but it's all based on the psychedelic map for change, both of these, let's say, experiences. And then the third thing that I'm currently experimenting with in a really, really like, it changes me every time I really do this work. I'm part of a group called Power Shift Journeys. And it's a bunch of people that have basically brought self-organization to businesses, holacracy and other concepts. And it's called Power Shift Journeys because we have a shared aim, right? The same interest and the same values to offer psychedelic-assisted professional development for people we call for-purpose agents. So these could be in corporates, these could be in Web3 companies and startups, wherever. But they do see themselves as exactly what it says on a tin, for-purpose agents. They have a purpose. They want to catalyze change. And we want to give them not just the classic tools of leadership development, but psychedelic-assisted leadership development in a way that does not compound existing power structures. And that's the challenge. So I'm a white man, for instance. How do I and other people create something that does not compound 500 years of colonialization or 10,000 years of patriarchy? And that's why it's called Power Shift Journeys. I'm an early contributor and I'm not quite sure where my place in that is, but it's a fascinating and daunting journey at the same time.
Yes. And the road will appear as you walk down that path.
Yeah, that's a nice one. Yeah, it will.
You know, I would love to just sit and talk to you about Web3. I know that you have a lot of ideas on Web3 and how they really relate to what we're discussing here. So I'd like to bring you on another time to really just dig into Web3 and what that looks like in terms of the evolution of humanity. But in the meantime, I absolutely appreciate you being here. You have touched on so many things. I'm sure all the listeners have lots of questions, interests, they've learned a lot. How does someone get in contact with you if they want to learn more?
The best way is actually LinkedIn. It's Marcus Struan. We can put it in the show notes. And then the website is called thepsychedelicmapforchange.com. Those are the two most relevant ones. Yeah.
Awesome. Check out Marcus on LinkedIn, thepsychedelicmapforchange.com. Thank you so much again, Marcus. We will be meeting soon.
Yes.
I know it. And we will come together like a supernova.
Nice one. Yes, I look forward to that.
Yes, me too. Thanks for being on the show, Marcus, and thanks for coming on the Alchemist Lounge.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening in to the Alchemist Lounge. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the podcast, please share it with others, post about it on social media, or leave a rating and review on Apple iTunes. To catch all the latest from Alex Atwood, you can check out his website at alexatwood.co. Thanks again, and we'll catch you next time at the Alchemist Lounge.